Jews have this underground network. That sounds great, sir.
Oh, God.
The lamb was eaten by the cat. The cat was beaten by the dog. The dog was beaten by a stick. The stick was burned by the fire. The fire was consumed by the water. The water was drunk by the bull. The bull was...
It goes all the way up to the angel of death. Is that too much? Is that complicated? Is your head spinning?
Yeah, it's complicated. It's intriguing. I want to know what they were doing that was against unity. The Jews saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?
Okay, listen, enough of that shit. This is a podcast, and we're not going to try to find, we're going to find the solution to anti-Semitism, okay? We're going to stop that right here, right now, from this stinking basement. When we get to the bottom of this, we're going to read from this mystery book, which you're not going to find out about until the end of the series, and we're going to really entertain every perspective. We're not going to say, oh, you can't say this, you can't say that. No, we're going to say everything. Because if we're not going to be able to talk about it, we're not going to be able to solve it. You know, we're going to really grab you in the kishke, and we're going to squeeze until we get something, right? Either a bowel movement or a freaking solution. We want to know what happened. What happened 3,500 years ago in Babylon that started this whole meshuggahs? And we want to finish it here in 2020. That's it.
Seth, how are you? It's been so long. I feel like we haven't done this in like forever. I feel I've been isolated in Israel.
You have.
Too long. I'm starting to smell a falafel.
It's been months.
You know how long it's been? Because my computer doesn't, I don't have my drives with me, so they don't do the auto backup. So it tells me, you haven't backed up.
So it counts the days.
You haven't backed up in 103 days. I'm like,
really? 103 days?
It's a long time, yeah.
I haven't backed up in like 236, but anyway, that means you haven't been back in the States.
Yeah, it means I haven't been back in the States.
It's the world is definitely changing. There's been so many phases through the virus. First it was like an adventure, and then it was like, okay, we're doing this thing, and now it's like this total just confusion. You know, everybody's telling we were open, we're not opening. The kids are going to school, we're not going to work. Who's going to work? Is anyone? You know, what's happening? It's like a whole confusion state now. And I heard about a new show actually that just came out, kind of like The Man in the High Tower, or the
is this The Man in the High? Don't you mean The Man in the High Castle?
Castle, yeah.
Oh, okay. That's,
I think so.
All right.
So there's another show that just came out, takes place with a Jewish family in Newark, New Jersey. It's called The Plot Against America. And it's what if Roosevelt didn't win? I think Lindbergh was the guy who won. And, you know, and our friend Henry Ford, we spoke about him. He becomes, I think, the Secretary of the Interior. He's going to become Secretary of the Interior. All of a sudden, it's very different, right? The U.S. isn't against Germany, doesn't fight a war. Like, that's how he wins against Roosevelt. Now, this is just from what I got from Wikipedia. I just heard about the show. But it's like, we won't go to war. You know, vote for Lindbergh, we won't go to war.
And then what happens?
There's no war against the Nazis. I don't know. I didn't watch the show, but this is all coming now. It's, you know what? Why am I bringing it up? Just because we're talking about this confusing time, and then I just heard about this show today, actually, and we're about to get back into our book here. It just feels like everything somehow, there's a thread through all of these different pieces, and I feel like we're going to somehow, it's going to all start getting cinched up.
Is the thread is, it's not going to happen to us? Is that the thread?
Well, I mean, it only happened every other time throughout history. Why it's right. Not going to happen here, though?
People are spending more time at home, so it'll be tougher to rally the brown shirts.
No. There was a terrible situation over the weekend where a police officer like killed a guy in the streets in Minneapolis or something like that. He put his knee on the guy's neck. White cop, black guy. Well, I saw today that there was. Look like hundreds of people in the streets throwing rocks, smashing cops' windows.
So you're saying
hundreds,
maybe thousands. So you're saying it's easy. It's easy to organize against.
Oh, in a second. This was also Memorial Day weekend last weekend, and there were thousands of people on the beach, thousands of people at pool parties. You could see pictures of it in every news outlet here. So in a day. It's over. You can get everyone back out in the street just like that. Not everyone, of course. You know, they're not going to pour out of the nursing homes, but young people, for sure.
So shouldn't get too comfortable is what you're saying.
Oh, I'm not making any conclusions.
You're not packing up. You're not making any conclusions. I'm just saying.
No, I'm just, you know, do you know what the theory, the old frog in the pot, the temperature just slowly gets warmer and warmer and the frog doesn't realize.
Oh, it's yeah. Yeah. It's a classic.
We'll be fine, Spiegler.
We'll be fine. Yes. So if you're listening, you're doing fine. You don't have to do anything. Don't pack. Don't panic. Just continue doing what you're doing. It's all going to work out by itself, as it has every generation since the fall of the last temple.
Let's say, because I'm sure the people who are listening to this are intelligent, let's just remember that every single day, white people and black people kill each other, and black people kill black people, and white people kill white people in America, and probably every other country. There's lots of terrible murders every day. Also, when we start to see that the news is showing a certain image to us, you know, actually in my news feed today on Google, I had 3 white black stories literally said, you know, woman calls cop on black man, cop kills black men, you know, and there was 3 of them actually today on my news feed. So when you see that, somebody somewhere decided that that's what, you know, it's time to sow seeds of strife.
No, just,
that doesn't happen. But, you know, just like a chance, like that's the story they decided to tell today for just no reason.
Well, it's in the air. I think if we've learned anything from this exploratory is that things happen throughout history in patterns. We live in a network and stuff just flows through it. And you can have love flow through it. Or you can have hate through it, flow through it. You can have indifference flow through it. You can have anger. You can have all sorts of emotions flow through the network. But when they do, they get it everywhere. I think that's kind of our whole premise, that small groups can bring catalyzed change in the network, kind of like hormones in the body. It just flows through the network. I think actually this virus is doing a little bit of that as well. It's interesting. I just find it interesting how people around the world were getting sick, not necessarily from direct contact with other sick people. A lot of people got sick were not from direct contact. I think it's something that flows in the system. It's a certain toxicity that brings out this sense of I'm done with this toxic environment. The body just goes into
it. It reminds me of how the mushrooms all connect underground and the trees all connect underground. There's these networks.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
The Jews also have this
Jews have this
connection
underground network. That sounds great, Seth.
Oh, God. Spiegler is supposed to bring out the best in me.
It only took 15 episodes for you to say that there's a secret Jewish cabal spreading hate or love around the world. If someone decided that we're just talking some, you know, nonsense, they left a long time ago. But if someone said that, well, there's definitely some recurring pattern here at work, then this person would be very wise to continue listening, because I think what we'll start to see that it doesn't just repeat itself with like the same intensity. It grows because there's always a growing imbalance, and eventually the system does a rebalancing act, and usually it's very violent. And that's the thing that I'm worried about. I think you're worried about, everybody's worried about it, that it's not going to end up with one isolated incident here, a shooting there, that sort of thing. It's about a trend, right? And how far is it? It's going. I just saw that today they said that more than 2,000 anti-Semitic crimes in Germany right now, the highest rate since 2001. So this is climbing. This is on an upward trajectory. This is not like, oh, there's always been anti-Semitism. We always have a little bit of that. No, it's like when it swells up to a certain level that it cannot be contained, and then something terrible happens. And I don't know what that terrible thing is, and I don't want to imagine it, but I sure want to stop it.
That's what I was thinking about when you were saying it. It sounds like, you know, a death sentence, but it's not. That's the whole premise. When my kids were in the Waldorf school, both of my, actually, my stepkids too, all went to the Waldorf school. So I had 4 kids pass through the Waldorf school. Mm-hmm. And they go, starting with like first grade or whatever it is, as they go through the grades, they learn all the civilizations from ancient Babylon and Greece and Rome and each civilization all the way up. And each of those civilizations are really mile markers on humanity's development until today. And you would say that today, this is the next empire. this is the next big civilization. And as you go, now the kids didn't learn this, but this is what we're reading in this book. This book is basically following those same milestones. Like the Jews have this parallel story alongside those same milestones. And we're coming now, what you're saying now reminds me of just like what we read, all these guys that we read about for all these last weeks. You know, today it would be Trump, Kushner, Pelosi, this one, that, Putin, you know, all the different powers and players. And this is the cycle that we're in. We need to see where we are, see that it is something that is recognizable, purposeful. There's something that's happening here that's not, it's not chaotic. It's not coming out of nowhere. It's not like we don't know what's going to happen. There's something, what is it we're doing then? Okay, we recognize what happened already all these times. Okay, it's happening now. The same cycle is happening again, but now we're aware of it. Now we can communicate to each other. Now we have everything we need in place to do the thing we need to do. So what is this thing that, you know, where are we at?
Okay, you know, we're not trying to look at every single event in history. What we're trying to say is there are patterns. And if you don't listen to what the pattern is showing, it's going to come bite you in the ass, is what we're saying. We don't want to reach the tipping point, because once it does, guess what? You can't stop it then. Then you just have to ride it out. Those things, once the process is already starts, a snowball, right? An avalanche, once it starts, you know, much more difficult to stop. There is no stopping. Like war. Speaking of war, we're also in a place in time where President of China says that we're starting to prepare for war. Israel and Hezbollah are getting ready to, you know, to lock arms again. There's a general, I don't know, what is it, a radicalization of the planet, and we're in it. We're in it, and somehow we say that.
So where is our control switch? Where is our
attitude? Where is our attitude? I think we can change our attitude.
That's what
we can grab. Yeah, I think.
That's what we can grab, and that's what we can, that's the controller that we can grab.
It's the only thing.
Manage this.
That's the only thing. I don't know, man. You're reading the news, looking at the fake news, looking at all this stuff. You can't make sense of anything. So much conflicting information, so much. I had a great conversation yesterday with another guest, potential guest for the show. He's a Muslim guy in Vienna, and he's doing a lot of Jewish Muslim conferences, trying to bring people together, create dialogue. He works in prisons. He works on de-radicalization of prisons. You know, can you imagine that?
De-radicalization.
Can you imagine that kind of job? How was your day today? Well, you know, it was an average day. People running.
De-radicalizing the radicals.
Yeah, de-radicalize a few people.
Wow.
He's very much interested in history. Had a very nice talk. He's very much interested in history. And I got the sense that he was interested in also in patterns and trying to understand why stuff happens. And I think it's leading us back, you know, into the book. We're in chapter 5, Birthplace of Zionism. And I think this is a good segue into it, because as I told you before, we have a tendency to be very much blind to why things happen the way they do. Right, like you walk down the street, you see the sidewalk is wet, so you can say, well, maybe it was raining a little bit before. But you don't ask a step beyond that, right? There's no, okay, why was it raining? Why did it rain? Average people don't ask that. They don't go to, oh, the pressure and the humidity. You just say it was raining, the sidewalk is wet, and it's done. And we're very myopic here as well in terms of history. We always look maybe one step behind, maybe two steps behind, but not much. If you talk to any person today on the street, well, the Israel's policies, that's what pisses the whole world, and everybody's against that, and stop mistreating Palestinians, and start doing this, and have all these demands, and this will solve everything. Right, because this created that, and that is it. And we're saying, what we're trying to do here in this program, is go you know, what was behind that? And then what was behind that? And what was behind that? And it's like that song, that the Jewish song in Passover, Chag Gadya, which I really hope you will sing for us. Chag Gadya, Chag Gadya, Chag Gadya, Zavim Rabba V'Trezu Zeh, Chag Gadya, Chag Gadya. In that song, if you're not Jewish, there's a song, and it's about a story about dad buying a little lamb in the market for the holiday. But then every verse in the song, every stanza, they go back and the lamb was eaten by the cat. The cat was beaten by the dog. The dog was beaten by a stick. The stick was burned by the fire. The fire was consumed by the water. The water was drunk by the bull. The bull was, it goes all the way up to the angel of death, right? That's the song. And to stop in the middle and just say, oh, what happened? Oh, it was the dog. The dog's fault. The dog bit the cat. The cat ate the lamb. That was it. Kind of doing a disservice if you're not tying the whole chain together. To me, when we talk about Zionism, which is a big point, everybody's, oh, it's the Zionism. You know, everything was fine until Zionism came about. And I think what we've seen from the book, no, it wasn't fine. There was always some Jewish movement, something that started and created a provoked reaction. To talk about Zionism in isolation, you know, to say why was there even Zionism in the first place, we have to look back a little bit, because the role that this will play later on in the Holocaust, the Jews in Germany, the Jews in Israel, that's a very big thing. And I learned in school that Zionism started when this guy Herzl with a big beard, he went on the porch and he said, "I have a dream moment. If you want it, it's not a fairy tale. We can have a Jewish state." And I thought that's how it was. He just figured Jews should go to Israel, but it wasn't so. There were so many things that were so many little snowballs that kicked off this particular snowball, and those snowballs also had to do with Jews and Jewish behavior and Jewish attitudes and the attitudes of the ruling class towards Jews. All of that happening in Europe in the 18th and 19th century. So that's what I hope to get into a little bit. I'm just saying that this episode and probably the one that will follow, they will be the precursors to the Holocaust, which we will get to. We will touch that very touchy subject because we have to. And to try to make sense a little bit of the Holocaust, you want to make sense of Zionism. And to make sense of Zionism, you want to make sense of what happened before, after the expulsion from Spain. And to make sense of that, you want to know what happened before and before and before. And every time we're seeing the same patterns.
By the way, so when we get to Germany, Germany is the height of civilization again, right? You have Einstein, yeah. And you have all these Nobel Prize winners, Nobel laureates there. You have incredible composers there. It's the height of civilization at the time. So, of course, that's where we're going to see the story repeat itself.
Exactly. So the role of Zionism later in the Holocaust cannot be understated. I'm not saying, if it's good or bad, you know, because people attribute the birth of the current state of Israel to that. It played a role also in the Holocaust, and also important to understand what started it. And everybody talks about these pogroms, these waves of pogroms that started it. This is the end of the 19th century, 1881, April 15. It was a vicious series of pogroms and riots that set off a whole reaction by the Jews. Those pogroms, by the way, were started as a reaction to Jewish activities. The Jews and the ruling czars of the time, Nicholas I, Alexander I, Alexander II, they have this relationship between them. That relationship provokes a certain action from the Jews living in Eastern Europe at the time. That action provokes a huge reaction by the local population, all these pogroms. These pogroms bring about the thought of, hey, we need a state because we're getting killed here. Maybe we should move to Israel and take control of our fate. Zionism was not merely a reaction to an old dream that Jews had. It was a reaction to pogroms that started as a reaction to the activity of Jewish people, that started as a reaction to a change in the policy of the governing czars to the Jewish population, and the Jews seizing that to make radical changes, not in the direction of unity. Is that too much? Is that complicated? Is your head spinning?
Yeah, it's complicated. It's intriguing. I want to know what they were doing that was against unity. I want to discover all of these things.
I want to discover too all these things. Yeah, I just did some reading before the show started, so that's why I sound so smart. So we're talking about Russia. We're talking about it's the time of the Napoleonic Wars. Napoleon's going through Europe. Having a good time there until he fails there with Russia, pulls back, and all the Jews are living in really appalling conditions. So this part of Eastern Europe.
This is
a few hundred years after the
300 years after Spain, right? 300 years after Spain.
Yeah.
And now the Jews are okay.
A lot of stuff is happening. This is not to say that everybody was just sleeping. Jews having a serious awakening. We're talking about the Renaissance, right? So Renaissance sweeping through Europe. All these great inventions, great really breakthroughs in culture and science and everywhere. And Jews were the ones there also paying for some of those things. And they're continuing their expansion through Europe. Eventually, through their very difficult lifestyle, you have this guy, the Baal Shem Tov, who in the 1700s, he decides that he needs to bring, to awaken the Jewish spirit of unity. He starts to teach again the common people, not just the traditional, how to follow the mitzvot, but he tries to get into the internality of things. What are we Jews all about? And he starts his tradition, the Hasidic tradition. Gathering people, stressing the unity, the joy, and then teaching those who are able to learn. And that spreads throughout Europe. So there's a great internal spiritual awakening, if you will, throughout Europe in that time. And Jews more or less sticking together through
that. That's 1800s.
Well, this is the end of the 1700s going into the 1800s. But
the awakening comes after the Baal Shem Tov, which would have been the 1800s. Right?
Leading 1770 something.
Okay.
If you want to get technical on dates, he died in 1779. So his whole legacy was like the middle of the 1700s. Well, we're not going to get into the history of Hasidic Judaism. I don't want to. The book says is that I'm just going to read this. So we're jumping ahead for a second to the Nazis. Two Jewish entities partook in the drama that unfolded when the Nazis first came to power. The Zionists in Palestine and German Jewry. The building of the national home began far from Palestine or from Germany. It began in Russia in 1881. On April 15th of that year, a long, deadly, and vicious series of pogroms and riots against Jews erupted in the city of Elizabethgrad, today's Kropivnitsky, and spread through most of southern Russia in the area of today's Ukraine. These pogroms were the catalyst for Zionism, which later produced the State of Israel, which later also played a big role in the Holocaust. We'll see that. I mean, that's a big spoiler. But the question is, I want to know what happened, what provoked these pogroms? Because we always see that the pogroms don't just happen by themselves. People don't just decide, hey, let's kill some Jews. There's always something. There's always a dynamic. That's something that we want to see. Let's read something, Seth.
What triggered the pogroms, which lasted over a year and became known as the Storms in the South, after their location in South Russia? It was the murder of the Russian Tsar Alexander II, who was ironically had a very positive attitude towards the Jews. Anti-Semites spread a rumor that the Jews killed the Tsar, and from here anger became quickly violent. The subsequent anti-Semitic pogroms resulted in a discontinuation of Jewish emancipation efforts and simultaneously the genesis of Zionism.
So emancipation efforts. So someone decided to emancipate the Jews. Where are we emancipating them from? From the shtetl? So you'd think that this is a good thing, right? Seth, if someone came to you, Seth, I want to emancipate you. Are you...
I was thinking of something different. I was thinking that if the Tsar was friendly to the Jews, so then the Jews were comfortable in Russia. Once he dies and the Jews aren't comfortable anymore, then they need
to... That's a common mistake that I think we all make. We think that something just It's much more complicated and nuanced. Unfortunately, I think we don't have time to get into it. Just to say that...
just to say how comfortable we are in America.
Just to say how comfortable we are in America, how the policies have really been very welcoming. And
so we don't think about leaving.
You think that you can just cross that little boundary, right? That separates, because we look like everyone else. We can just do anything we want. If we break away from that ideal, that's when the reaction starts.
We don't all need to move to some country in the Middle East. Like, we're talking about an idea, right? The same way when we talked about assimilation, we weren't talking about just, you know, I mean, Moses, you could say he married a non-Jewish. We're talking about the idea, right? So right. If a Jewish person is in New Jersey or Toronto or wherever, but he has this idea of unity and connection, so he's already doing the thing. He's already doing the thing that the Jews have not been doing, which has been causing them troubles. The actual loving your neighbor as yourself, all that stuff, that is the thing. You don't need to go, you don't need to buy a ticket to the Middle East in order to be in this state, this degree called Israel.
Well, I think that's what we're trying to get to. But for now, it's still mired in a lot of political and economic drama and all the rest of it. If you see, what happens is, I do want us to read something, and I feel like we're running out of time. We're not reading anything. But Alexander I decides that he wants to try to integrate Jews into the Russian state if they converted to Christianity. If I can only get more Jews to be a bit more Christian, everything would be fine. This is another person who did not learn the lesson from in time of the Spanish Inquisition. So he started the Society of Israelite Christians, and they promised converts land for settlement in the areas of New Russia, and all those great ideas to get it underway. But suddenly he dies of typhus, or he becomes a monk. Nobody's really sure. And his younger brother becomes the Tsar, Nicholas I. And that's when things kind of take a turn for, maybe you can read from page 101 there.
His younger brother ruled from the time of his death until 1855 and continued his brother's efforts to impel the Jews to convert to Christianity as a means to integrate them into Russian society. Under Nicholas I, the government went beyond attempting to convert Jews. The Tsar attempted to turn the Jews away from their traditional occupations and integrate them in the general economic life of Russia. He also imposed on the Jews a painful mandatory conscription of Jews into military service as a means of correcting their character.
That's great.
Following conscription and the economic reformations came even worse steps. Attempts to reform Jewish education, which held the nation together. From the early 1840s, Tsar Nicholas took steps to introduce a comprehensive reform in the status of Jews and to intervene in their internal cultural life. Traditional education and its key text, the Talmud, became the major target. To the Tsar and his ministers, the Jewish religion was an extremely influential element that prevented the Jews from becoming integrated into the Jewish state. They believed that the religious intellectual pursuits of the Jews, in particular their intensive study of the Talmud and the rabbinical literature, engendered xenophobia, offensive traits, and economic damage. In other words, Jewish scholarship was officially perceived as a political element hostile to the state. The negative, almost demonic image of the Talmud as hostile to Christianity and spreading hatred of human society in general became a major issue in the various texts describing the behavior of a Jewish.
So basically he's saying you have a problem, we love you, Jews are great, they bring great qualities to the table, we just want to get rid of the stuff that's a little xenophobic and threatening
Jewish
Christianity and just overly Jewish tones, and just if you just get rid of that, get rid of all, you know, 3,000 years of education. Interestingly, South Korea, I think, is one of the leading country studying Talmud. They're trying to figure out how to be as smart as Jews, so they introduced Talmud to schools. That's nice. But that just goes to the heart of it. So we'll help you be less Jewish so you can join the society. But then what happens, if you continue what Solomon Luria observed, that's the key moment here.
When Jews turn their backs on their Wait, are we
yes, pages
ago? Or something? No, I know, but it's like the same. We already read this in every century.
That's a paradox.
When Jews turn their back on their co-religionists and attempt to assimilate, they arouse anti-Semitism, which paradoxically blames them of being separatists and reluctant to assimilate. Same thing happened in Spain, right?
Yeah, same thing happened in Spain, everywhere.
But the opposite paradox works just as well. When Jews unite among themselves and increase their cohesion, anti-Semitism decreases. Wherever they are attacked, they restore their ancient bond, which was shattered along with the walls of Jerusalem back in the first century CE. And even though their restored unity is currently self-serving and transient, contrary to their vocation to spread light of unity to the nations, it is nonetheless powerful enough to maintain their survival.
Though certainly not
unscathed.
It's interesting, right? The same thing that's happened over and over, and it continues. Read the next one. I mean, this is just good.
Very few leaders noticed that recurrence in history, and therefore fell. But you, dear reader, here you see it very clearly.
You see it very clearly. You can now.
And therefore,
what's going to happen?
And you can tell everyone. Okay. Few leaders noticed the recurrence in history, and therefore fell for the trap of attempting to force their will on the Jews. And Nicholas I was no exception. Paradoxically, writes Bartol, the Tsar achieved the very opposite of what he had intended, which was to disperse the Jewish society. Frameworks of social organization and cohesion continued to operate, preserving the distinctive identity of the Jewish
ethnos.
What the Russian government sought to eradicate through formal integration grew in strength and found other channels of continuity.
Meaning, despite the efforts of the government, the majority of Jewish society maintained their traditional lifestyle. It was almost like an anti-reaction, right? When they tried to, when the outside forces try to make them less Jewish by force, they, you know, instinctively unite, and they actually, you know, they grow stronger. I'll tell you what it is. If you have a four-year-old son and you've been quarantined, you know what an ublik is. Ublik is a non-Newtonian fluid. It's very simple. It just means that it doesn't obey the same laws of fluid. I'll tell you, it all relates. It all relates. When you make an ublik, you have a bowl with this substance, right? It looks like a puddle, right? You move the bowl, it all quivers. If you hit it, you can't get through. It becomes solid, like you hit a wall. But if you take your fingers and you just let them run through it, it's just liquid. You just get in. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Again, if you have a four-year-old child at home, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, you can go ahead and make it. You can make it from corn flour and water. Very easy. Read about it online. What I'm saying is, I think Jews behave in a non-Newtonian way. If you try to force your way into them, there's going to be a huge reaction. They're going to unite and you can't break through. But if you say, hey, let's be friends. Why don't you come over and
here's some land in southern Russia.
Which is exactly what happens. If we probably won't have time to get to it, but it's immediately, you know, all that stuff that Nicholas I tried to do, they did not give rise to a decisive change in the relationship between the Russian government and the Jews. On the contrary, it created suspicion and hostility that became the basis for future radicalism to appear among the Jews, because they didn't like what the government was doing. And then Alexander II comes, and he was being very friendly. He was being very, very nice. He wasn't the military guy, and he was like, hey, basically reversed. He tried to reverse all the stuff that his father did, all those policies in education and society and economic affairs, including that attitude towards the Jews. And that opened up the doors to the shtetl, and Jews started to move out and started to create all these movements in Russia, which we'll learn about, I hope, next week.
What kind of movements?
Well, you know how they say that Jews are capitalists and they're communists. They kill Christ and they created Christianity.
Marxism and all these different things.
Yeah, so the same thing here. Jews were, you know, separatists keeping to themselves, and they also created, they were also leaders of social reform.
Okay, so once the new Tsar comes along and he is good to them, they loosen up, they start integrating and start creating all of these different forms.
They move away from the ideal. They move away. They expose their vulnerability, and they inevitably get mixed up with all sorts of bad elements. And they end up planting a bomb that kills someone special and important, which we're going to hear about it next week.
Okay, in summary here, if the host country is good to the Jews end up integrating.
Jews are Ublik.
When the Ublik,
Jews
right.
are Ublik. Jews are Ublik. If you apply force, they unite.
So hold on. So that's only two options. Either we're left alone and we just go out and we create all kind of stuff but don't fulfill our destiny, or we get beat on and then we unite. So there's those are the two things that we've known up until now.
Because I think this is just a preserving mechanism from nature.
Okay, so fine. That's two things. We're aiming for now is that if we can unite without being beaten.
Yes.
Right? That's the new thing. So the book is going back and forth between these two states, and we're talking about a third thing, which is we have to discover.
It's no secret. Again, if you've listened, we said it. This is that radical approach that we take our destiny into our own hands. We learn from history, and we actually try to apply that quality of unity, not just on ourselves, not just as a reaction to pressure, but among everyone, as a reaction to nature's pressure on us.
We determine our own future.
We determine our future.
We're not waiting for anything.
We're not waiting for anything.
We determine our future.
Yes. Well, that's all we have to say. This is The Jew Function. And
thank you, guys.
You can find us on Twitter, Facebook at The Jew Function, on YouTube, or wherever podcasts are sold. You can find us there. It's JewFunction.com for a discussion about the root and solution to anti-Semitism based on the laws of nature. And YouTube, all those interesting, honest conversations with a bunch of interesting conversations coming up. So stay tuned for that. Think about unity, maybe. No?
Definitely.
All right. From Israel.
From Jersey. Good night.
Good night.